The Knowledgeable Provider podcast is intended primarily to entertain, also to inform, but it is not a substitute for actual medical training and should not be used by anyone to diagnose or treat any medical condition in themselves or others. If you need medical advice, please make an appointment to see your own knowledgeable medical provider. The opinions expressed by me and anyone else who happens to appear on the podcast are solely those of the people expressing them and are not necessarily representative of any other entities. Other than the lunches at the office, I do not receive any sort of compensation from pharmaceutical or medical device companies, and I have no other relevant financial disclosures. Look, this is all for fun, okay? Don't sue me. All right, on with the show. Hello, welcome back to Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. This week, I want to talk about an interesting case that's been going on in our practice. One of those things that sort of came up out of the blue that we don't see very often. It's a case of pneumonitis caused by amiodarone. This is the first time I've shared a specific case from my current practice, I think. Really, all the story time episodes have been things from my EMS career so far. Because to be honest, most of the things that happen in our practice now are not super exciting. But I think this is actually really interesting and a good learning experience. So maybe someone else will find this useful if you see anything similar in your own practice. So the patient is a gentleman in his early 80s. He's an established patient, been with the practice for a long time. We know him pretty well. Basically a healthy guy, still in pretty good shape, still very active physically, mentally sharp, nothing real unusual in his medical history. He's on kind of the usual medicine, calcium channel blocker, statin, diabetes well controlled, just on metformin. He takes a PPI, NSAID as needed for joint pain, and an 81 milligram aspirin daily, and then some Singulair for allergies. I'm going to start this story in May of 2022. He comes in and sees me. He's complaining of intermittent chest pain that's been going on for the past 2 weeks. Sharp pain that starts without any apparent trigger, resolves quickly. It's been happening about 6 or 8 times every day. And he's also noticed some shortness of breath with physical exertion. That becomes kind of an important point. And this is something that you get with taking care of established patients that you've seen forever. He actually had been complaining of shortness of breath with exertion for years. I look back through all of his notes, and the first time he brought it up with Dr. James was in 2015. And he doesn't seem to mention it at every single visit, but very often when we see him, he kind of has the same complaint. Not the pain, but the shortness of breath with exertion. And over the years, of course, we've kept an eye on his heart. All of our patients get an EKG annually. We've never seen anything show up there. For a while, there was some thought that it was being caused by acid reflux, so we've been treating that for a long time. We've sent him to ENT to be evaluated. In 2018, we actually sent him to pulmonology to be evaluated. Never really with any explanation found for why he was short of breath all the time. So in a situation like this, where a patient comes in complaining of the same thing they've been complaining of for years, that's kind of dangerous, right? Because either you know them already, or you look back in the chart and go, okay, so you're short of breath, you've been short of breath, what's different today? And the difference was the pain, and also that the shortness of breath had gotten to the point now that he was actually having to stop what he was doing and take breaks. And that element had not been typical for him as well. Of course, he didn't tell me that. I had to get that from his wife on the phone later. So he comes in, intermittent chest pain, worsening shortness of breath. He really looked pretty well. I did note that you could tell he was having a little bit of increased work of breathing just while he was standing and moving around. But otherwise, in general, he did not look sick. However, his heart rate was above 150. His other vital signs were fine. So, of course, we do an EKG, and lo and behold, narrow complex tachycardia, rate about 140, 150. It looks regular on the EKG. I'm sitting here looking at his EKG now in his chart. And it was fast enough that you really couldn't tell whether it was SVT or atrial tach or atrial fib slash flutter. It's just too fast. So I tried to slow him down. I got him to do a Valsalva maneuver, which didn't change his heart rate. So then I tried a carotid sinus massage, and that actually did slow it down enough to see the baseline, which I thought was pretty neat. And I caught that on a 12 lead. At the time, after I looked at it, I decided that it was a second degree. I'm just reading my note here. I decided it was a second degree type 2 AV block with 2-to-1 conduction. So looking at it now, I guess I can see where I would have come up with that. It still looks pretty regular. The baseline, I guess, could have been multiple P waves like you would see with that rhythm. But anyway, obviously abnormal, obviously not good. He's stable. I would have called him stable, but he doesn't have a cardiac history. He doesn't have a cardiologist. So what do? I don't like sending people to the emergency room. I don't mind seeing a patient complaining of chest pain as long as they're not dying, you know. As long as they're not in extremis, I generally will see the patients and try to do something myself instead of just automatically sending them to the emergency room. Because I know what I'm sentencing them to, right? It's going to be hours. They're going to be over there for forever. More than likely, there's not much wrong with them anyway, and it's going to be all for nothing. So I really, really try hard not to do that. But in this situation, he's been in this very rapid heart rate for who knows how long. He's an 80-plus-year-old gentleman. He came there by himself, drove himself from a neighboring town, by the way, not even from a local place. So I really don't feel comfortable just letting him go. So I say, I'm sorry, but you have to go to the emergency room, you know, now. I don't trust him to go over there by himself, right? Our office is directly across the street from the hospital. If you step out the front door of our building, you're looking right at the emergency room entrance directly across the street. So I'm definitely not calling an ambulance unless somebody is, you know, dead. But I also feel weird about just telling him to go over there on his own. What if that is the moment that this decides to turn into V-fib and he crashes his car and dies? You know, you go into what if mode, liability mode. And also, I don't really trust him not to just drive back home to where he came from. So I go, all right, you got to go to the emergency room and I'm going to take you over there. So I grab my little BLS airway jump bag that I keep hidden in the office just in case. And I grab the AED off the wall. And I stick him in my car and we drive the 0.01 miles to the emergency room. I drop him off. We don't manage patients in the hospital at all. And I don't even know anybody at Decatur ER. So when I take a patient over there, I literally drop him off at the door and be on my way. I think some of the patients still think that we're supposed to run in there and tell everybody what to do. But I'm sure you can imagine how well that would go over. So I just don't even try. I'll give the triage nurse a brief report. Hand him or her the demographics, and here's the patient. Have a great day. I don't try to stick around or be involved any further than that. So just reading the note from the ER, he told them pretty much the same thing he told me. One thing I did not mention is that he has a history of pulmonary embolism that happened after a surgery way back in the past. That was considered a provoked clot, so he's not on chronic anticoagulation. That would be why he's taking the aspirin every day. Of course, they do his labs. Everything's essentially fine. They test him for COVID. His TSH is normal. His troponin's normal. He's not anemic. His metabolic panel's fine. It turns out his rhythm is atrial flutter with rapid ventricular response. So in the ER, they give him a dose of metoprolol and notice that it slowed his heart rate down just for a few seconds. Then they give him diltiazem. I'm not sure if they started a drip or just gave him a bolus, but that along with some IV fluid got the rate down enough for long enough where they could tell that it was atrial flutter. So they then gave him a dose of Lovenox and admitted him. Of course, they're concerned about a PE because of that history. This particular ER doctor is excellent at documentation, very super detailed notes. She asked him all about any recent long-term immobility or travel or anything like that. The only thing was that he had had several dental procedures over the past couple of weeks. But other than that, no reason really to suspect the PE other than the history. They did go ahead and get a CTA of the chest, which was negative. There's a long note here about, I guess they had a bunch of sick patients and there was some delay in getting his treatment done. And there was some question about whether or not he was going to be admitted. I don't know what the COVID situation was around that time, May of 22, but it seems like it was a bad day, especially if somebody took the time to write all these details about all the interactions and things that happened. But eventually they did get him admitted. I think I took him over there about between three and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by 6 o'clock, they decided to admit him. So he wasn't there for a terribly long time before they got anything done. So at any rate, I don't think it made any difference in the outcome. The next day, seen by cardiology. Seems like he was looking pretty stable at that point. Heart rate was around 110. The cardiologist calls the EKG atrial flutter with rapid ventricular rate and episodes of variable atrioventricular conduction, comma, new onset. So he got put on a diltiazem drip after cardiology saw him. So I guess they did not start a drip while he was in the ER or overnight on the floor, but of course his rate was down, so maybe they wouldn't have thought about doing it at that point. They go ahead and start anticoagulation with Eliquis. They decide to watch him overnight and see if he's going to convert. It seems that he does not convert, so the following day, they decide they're going to do a TEE, transesophageal echo, but it seems like they had trouble getting the probe through his esophagus. There was a lot of resistance when they were trying to pass the probe, so they did not complete the TEE. So they decide, okay, we're just going to continue the rate control and anticoagulation. We'll keep watching him, see what happens. So that would be day 3 of his hospitalization. Day 4, symptomatically, still fine. Blood pressure's good. Heart rate's now down into the 80s. Still in atrial flutter. So they decide, all right, we're going to discharge him today on p-o-diltiazem along with the Eliquis, and we'll follow him as an outpatient. He was instructed to come back to the cardiology clinic in 7 to 10 days. They also wanted him to get an EGD to figure out what was going on in his esophagus, why they couldn't get that ultrasound probe down. So he goes to the cardiologist as instructed. He has his EGD scheduled, hasn't been done yet. Still very stable, asymptomatic from a cardiac standpoint. Not really complaining of anything at this point other than some mild tachycardia in the mornings. Heart rate at that visit was 99, blood pressure 122 over 82. So as far as meds at this point, we're still doing diltiazem and Eliquis. They decide they're going to add some metoprolol since he's still having a little bit of tachycardia. He is still in atrial flutter at this point. So they decide they're going to wait on the EGD and see what they find there. And they're going to have him come back to the clinic in 2 weeks to talk about trying the TEE again and cardioverting him. 4 days later, he gets his EGD. It says everything was normal, but they also went ahead and did some dilation of his esophagus. I take it from the note that that was just done just in case, just to make sure they could get the TEE done, but it doesn't seem like he really had any kind of significant stricture or anything. So about 3 weeks later, he goes in and has his TEE. Seems like it went fine. They didn't have any trouble passing the probe this time. The echo is normal. The valves look pretty good. The septa look pretty good. EF of at least 60%. No clot, no effusion, normal echo. So they go ahead and cardiovert him immediately after the echo. They do 120 joules synchronized cardioversion, and he converts to sinus rhythm. They consider it a success. A week later, they see him back in the cardiology clinic. He reported that he felt a lot better for about 3 days after the cardioversion, but then he started feeling fatigued again. He mentioned that he was feeling some lightheadedness with postural changes and also had a little bit of nasal congestion, postnasal drainage kind of stuff going on. No chest symptoms, no shortness of breath. The EKG that day reveals that he's in atrial fib. They feel like that probably explains why he's feeling fatigued. He's doing fine with the anticoagulation. So they decide they're going to try some rhythm control. So this is the day that the amiodarone is started. They put him on a dose of 200 milligrams daily. They continue the diltiazem and the Eliquis. And they plan to bring him back in a month to talk about trying the cardioversion again. And here is where things go south a bit. Story gets a little more complicated, a little more interesting. 3 days after his cardiology appointment, he comes to the emergency room, complaining of dizziness, abdominal pain, swelling, and uncontrolled hiccups that he tells the ER doctor has been going on for 3 or 4 days. He says for the past 3 days, the fatigue and malaise have been getting worse. He's noticed increasing abdominal distension, decreasing exercise tolerance. He tells the ER doctor that he can barely get around the house because he feels so bad. According to the documented physical exam, he appears lethargic. His blood pressure is high when he initially arrives, 158 over 111. Heart rate is in the 80s to 100s, it looks like. Of course, they repeat labs. Sodium of 110, is that right? Jeez. Kidneys are okay. Sugar's okay. There's a little bit of liver inflammation. AST, ALT, and ALTFOS are all elevated. Albumin and bilirubin are okay. He's not anemic, 12 and 35. He doesn't have a white count, 7.2. Lipase is fine. There's some protein in his urine. Other than that, the urine's okay. So, they do a portable chest x-ray, which shows small bilateral pleural effusions, bibasilar atelectasis plus or minus pneumonia. They send him for a CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. And lo and behold, he has a big old pericardial effusion. The radiologist described it as moderate to large. They don't say anything about any pneumonia there. Curious if anybody documented any heart sounds. Under the cardiovascular exam, it says no edema, no JVD, tachycardia, and irregular. Doesn't say anything about heart sounds. So they consult nephrology. They start some IV Lasix. They talk to cardiology and general surgery. They decide that he doesn't need any kind of urgent intervention for this pericardial effusion, and he gets admitted. The first cardiology note, they did not hear any kind of murmurs, rubs, gallops, etc. So at this point, cardiology's take is they don't know where the pericardial effusion came from, but they're suspicious for malignancy because it developed rapidly and because of the hyponatremia that's associated with it. They're checking inflammatory markers, CEA, and blood cultures. They're going to do another echo. They're stopping his Eliquis. The Lasix they gave him resulted in 2 liters of output, and the swelling he was having in his lower extremities resolved. They're continuing the amiodarone while he's in the hospital. The next day, he's feeling better. His sodium's come up to 125, and the surgeon has decided that they want to take him to the operating room once his sodium is normalized to evacuate the pericardial effusion and to biopsy the pericardium. Next day, still feeling the same. Sodium's now up to 135. Kidney function's fine. Vital signs are fine. So the day after that, he went to surgery. They did a pericardial window, drained out 120 milliliters of fluid from around the heart, and got a biopsy. He's looking a lot better, feeling a lot better. His sodium is trending down again. I'm not sure what the actual value was. They decide they're going to give him a dose of tolvaptan, which is a vasopressin antagonist, which would cause more excretion of free water. The cardiologist that's seen him this day now feels like he may have initially had pericarditis, developed some light bleeding on top of that, that led to the rapid accumulation of fluid, which may have triggered SIADH and the subsequent hyponatremia. How about that? They're still thinking maybe cancer, because of course hyponatremia and then also pericardial effusion both can be associated with small cell lung cancer. Next day is looking better. Cardiologist is still suspicious for pericarditis. They start him on a steroid and colchicine, still waiting the biopsy result. Sodium's fine. We're still on amiodarone. They're going to restart anticoagulation the next day and planning to send him home pretty soon as long as he stays stable. Following day still looks good, but his heart rate had increased to about 130 while he was just minimally moving around, like sitting up in bed, eating breakfast. They're still doing the steroids and colchicine. They've restarted the Eliquis. Now they're doubling his amiodarone to 200 milligrams twice daily and also upping his metoprolol because of that rate. Next day, they notice some swelling in his hands. So they give him another dose of Lasix and they put him on spironolactone. They're upping his metoprolol again because heart rate is, I think, around 110 at this point. Sodium's still okay, 135. All his other labs are all right. Next day, his heart rate's down into the 90s. They give him another dose of tolvaptan because the sodium's a bit lower. They note that his CRP was 94 when he first came in, and now it's down to 8. They got the biopsy result back. They found evidence of patchy chronic inflammation and fibrosis, and there was no malignancy in the cytology. So now they're thinking that this was pericarditis, which caused the pericardial effusion. Following day, looking good. Heart rate's controlled. Sodium's 134. And ultimately, he goes home that day. He's going home on amiodarone, cortisone, Lopressor, and Eliquis. He did come to see us, I think, 4 days after he was discharged. He's feeling a little weak, but otherwise seems pretty okay. Heart rate's good, 70. He reports a little bit of diarrhea, so we hope that's just from the colchicine that he's taking. We repeat a CMP, CBC, and a CRP. I guess they're going to use that CRP to help titrate the colchicine. Sodium came back at 133. Still some liver inflammation going on. AST, ALT, ALK, FOS are all elevated. Now his albumin's a little bit low. His bilirubin's okay. And his CRP was down to 2.8. We saw him again for his routine annual visit about 2 weeks after that. And he's looking good that day, feeling better. Blood pressure's fine. Heart rate's 100. The liver numbers are all back to normal. Sodium's still at 133. CRP's down to 0.9. So yay, headed the right direction. 2 months later, he sees cardiology as an outpatient, and now they want to try cardioverting him again since now he's been on the amiodarone for over 6 weeks. So they cardiovert him again. They shocked him with 120 joules, and he went into sinus rhythm, did fine. Cardiology actually saw him about 4 months after he was cardioverted. Seemed like he was doing okay. They talk about tapering the amiodarone in several months, but they ultimately leave it on. They stopped the colchicine at that visit. We see him back for his 6 month visit just 2 days after this cardiology visit. That day, his sodium was down to 131. Everything else looked pretty okay. We don't see him again till another 6 months go by. Doesn't seem like much has happened with cardiology. At this point, he's still on the amiodarone, but it's been decreased to just 200 milligrams a day, according to our charting. I don't have a cardiology note from around that time. About 2 months later, he presents to the emergency room at a different hospital, complaining of primarily shortness of breath. By the time he got to the ER, he was pretty hypoxic. They actually called it hypoxic respiratory failure. His SpO2 was down to 86, 87% on room air. He had a CT. which revealed bilateral pneumonia and still small pleural effusions on both sides. He got worse through the night. They put him on BiPAP. His pro-BNP was a little bit elevated, so they're worried about heart failure. It's like his heart rate's okay. Blood pressure's a little bit low, 108 or 52. It looks like he's actually in normal sinus rhythm now. Sodium stable, 133 still. All the rest of his labs look okay. They actually stopped his amiodarone while he was hospitalized because of the respiratory status. That was very prescient. But they didn't call it amiodarone pneumonitis. He comes to see us about 2 weeks after that. Ultimately, they ended up finding that he had rhinovirus, and then also he contracted a urinary tract infection while he was in the hospital. He went home on antibiotics and on supplemental oxygen, which is a new thing for him. A month after that, November of 23, he's back in the emergency room complaining of shortness of breath. And it seems like he's pretty sick, pretty short of breath, pressure's kind of low. He's got a white count this time, 13.7. They do a chest x-ray that shows diffuse bilateral infiltrates consistent with pulmonary edema. They do a chest CT that's kind of equivocal. So they start him on Levaquin. They give him some Lasix. They put him on BiPAP. They admit him. Cardiology sees him. They note that his amiodarone was stopped when he was hospitalized at the previous place. They also note that he went back into atrial fib. So here's the first time anybody says possible amiodarone toxicity. The assessment is acute respiratory failure with hypoxemia, underlying differential diagnosis of possible amiodarone toxicity. That's the first time I've seen that specifically mentioned. I'd like to point out that was a nurse practitioner that wrote that note. Strong work. It looks like he had actually been on and off of steroids a few times after he left the other hospital. Seems like he did better when he was put on steroids, got worse when he was taken off of steroids. So by the next day, we're calling it amiodarone-induced pulmonary toxicity. Pulmonology sees him. The impression is amiodarone-induced pneumonitis. They mention the admission to the other hospital and that the respiratory panel was only positive for rhinovirus. According to the pulmonologist, what he had did not seem like a rhinovirus sort of pneumonia because he had slowly progressive shortness of breath over a 4 to 8 week period, which seems more like amiodarone pneumonitis. So I guess that moment there is where the official diagnosis was really made by pulmonology. So looks like they send him home on steroids and supplemental oxygen. Cardiology has now put him on Sotalol and he's back in sinus rhythm. He's going to stay on the anticoagulation. And that is the last time that he has been back to the hospital. He follows up with pulmonology, the same pulmonologist that saw him in the hospital, and the same one that did his evaluation several years ago. He's gotten better with steroids. He's sort of weaning off of the supplemental oxygen. That's November of 23. December of 23, he's still getting better. Now he's only using his oxygen at night. Still on a low dose of prednisone, but he's weaning down off of that as well. January 24, continuing to wean the steroids, still doing supplemental oxygen at night. We see him a month later for his routine follow-up. He's still on steroids. He's not using oxygen at all anymore now, and he's looking much better. And that's where we are currently. So, wow, holy crap, he went through the ringer. So amiodarone, let's talk about it. According to the Wikipedia page, it was first made in 1961. They started using it for chest pain, believed to be related to the heart. They pulled it from the market 6 years later because of its side effects. Then in 1974, they figured out it worked for arrhythmias and reintroduced it. Now it's on the WHO list of essential medicines. Apparently in 2021, it was the 235th most commonly prescribed medication in the United States, more than a million prescriptions. I would not have guessed that. The things that I generally keep in the front of my head about amiodarone are that it has a super long half-life. According to Hippocrates, the half-life is 58 days, which can be variable due to slower elimination from plasma tissues. So once you put somebody on amiodarone, that's going to be in them for a long time, even after you stop it. The other thing in the front of my brain about amiodarone is that it screws with the thyroid. The chemical structure of amiodarone is very similar to thyroxine, and it also contains iodine. It can actually cause hypo or hyperthyroidism. There's a black box warning for amiodarone about this pulmonary toxicity. Some version of it happens in 10 to 17% of patients, and it's actually fatal in 10% of the patients it happens to. So it's a big deal. Obviously, it was a big deal for our guy. You're supposed to get a baseline chest x-ray and pulmonary function test before you start the medicine. It's important that the diffusion capacity is included with the pulmonary function testing because a lot of times amiodarone will affect that without causing any symptoms. And you're supposed to re-examine the patient, do a chest x-ray every 3 to 6 months while they're taking the medication. Another black box warning is for hepatotoxicity. It seems like our guy had that, or at least the medicine probably caused his liver enzymes to go up. It doesn't seem like anybody really ever commented on that in any of his notes, but we did see that his enzymes were elevated while he was on the medication, and now they're back to normal. Obviously, he had some other stuff going on, but that seems pretty likely. The medication very commonly causes some mild elevation of LFTs, but it can lead to overt liver failure. So obviously, you want to get a baseline liver function testing before they start medication and then be monitoring that frequently while they're on it. The guidance is to stop or decrease the dose if the liver enzyme elevation goes above 3 times the upper limit of normal, or double whatever their baseline was if it was elevated before you started. Amiodarone can have pro-arrhythmic effects, so it can actually have a paradoxical effect and do the opposite of what it's supposed to do for arrhythmias. It can cause significant heart block or bradycardia, so you shouldn't give it to people who already have high degree heart block or symptomatic bradycardia that don't already have a pacemaker. And the fourth little gem on the black box warning is for appropriate use. This is from Hippocrates. It says, restrict use to indicated life-threatening arrhythmias due to drug-associated toxicity. So probably shouldn't use this unless you really have to. And apparently they really have to a lot. You really should start people on this in a situation where they're being monitored closely, like in an inpatient situation where their EKG is being monitored closely and somebody can intervene if they have a problem. So I've definitely never started anybody on amiodarone in my little clinic, and I don't plan to. That would be a cardiology thing every time. The indications for amiodarone really are ventricular arrhythmias, including VFib and pulseless VTAC. Amiodarone is on the ACLS algorithm for VFib and VTAC, both with and without a pulse. Using it for atrial fib is actually off-label, and any use in pediatric patients is off-label. Other contraindications to be aware of would be an allergy to iodine or an allergy to corn if you're giving the IV form, which contains dextrose. Lots of drug interactions with amiodarone, like a shit ton. Lots of potential adverse reactions. I'll just go down the list and hit the high points here. Let's see. There's one. Death associated with IV use. Neonatal gasping syndrome. Sounds pleasant. Rhabdomyolysis. Hallucinations. Peripheral neuropathy with long-term use. Optic neuritis or neuropathy. And blood dyscrasias. Hey man, can I just get the ablation? I can totally see how a patient getting put on some medicine and then going and reading the list of potential adverse effects could freak out about all the things a medicine could cause. It kind of drives me crazy when they do that, but I understand it. I prefer that to not even being able to tell what medicines you're on or what they're for or anything. There's an up-to-date article specifically about amiodarone pulmonary toxicity. It's written by Dr. Edward Chan and Dr. Talmadge King Jr. The most common type of amiodarone-induced lung injury is interstitial pneumonitis, and I believe that is what our patient had. Usually it presents after the patient's been on the medication for at least 2 months, and especially when the dose exceeds 400 milligrams a day. So our guy was never on more than 400 milligrams a day, and the symptoms that led him into the hospital with the pericardial effusion started like the same day or the next day after the cardiology appointment where they started the medication. So you have to wonder if that initial situation with the pericarditis was caused by the amiodarone or whether it was just a coincidence. I can only find one case report of a situation where a patient got pneumonitis and pericardial effusion together from taking amiodarone. This is from 1985. It was published in the International Journal of Cardiology. And of course, my search consists of a Google search, so I'm not saying I've exhaustively combed the medical literature for this, but that's the only thing that comes up when you just Google search for those terms. So maybe it was just a coincidence. The note from the cardiology clinic that day they started the medicine did mention that he was complaining of some kind of upper respiratory, nasal congestion-y kind of symptoms. So maybe there was some viral thing happening that just happened to occur at that time. I don't know. I guess we don't know the answer to that, really. But as far as I can tell, it seems like that particular situation probably was not due to the amiodarone at first. It seems like we don't really know what the mechanism of the amiodarone-induced lung injury really is. The two guesses are that it's either a direct toxic injury to the lung cells or an indirect immunologic reaction. Seems like there would probably be some genetic component of a person's susceptibility to this. People with pre-existing lung disease may be more prone to this. Common clinical manifestations of this are pretty much what we saw in our guy. Insidious onset of non-productive cough and or difficulty breathing. Those symptoms are present about 50 to 75% of people when they show up with this. Fever, a little bit less common. Pleuritic chest pain, weight loss, and generally feeling bad may also be reported. This usually happens within 6 to 12 months of starting the medicine, but they have seen it within 2 months and after several years being on the medication. Typical lab findings, elevated white count, LDH, CRP, and SED rate. Usually do not see eosinophilia or positive ANA. And if you check the serum amiodarone levels, which I don't think that was ever done for him, they're usually within the normal range. So it's not like they're getting some super therapeutic dose of the medicine that's causing this. It doesn't seem like there's any particular lab test that's especially helpful for diagnosing this. There's a proposed marker called KL6, which is secreted by a specific type of cell in the lung when it's dividing, proliferating. So that is used as a marker of disease and some other interstitial lung diseases, but it's definitely not specific to amiodarone-induced lung injury. As far as imaging on a high-res CT, you might see attenuation in the lungs as well as the liver and the spleen just because of the extra iodine that accumulates from the amiodarone. But that's something you might see in anybody taking amiodarone. So that's not really specific for the lung injury either. They will see other lung abnormalities on the chest x-ray or CT, but again, not really specific. Pulmonary function testing, pretty nonspecific. They can do a bronchoalveolar lavage, but that's really more to help exclude other things. Again, not specific for amiodarone toxicity. One thing that shows up in the BAL is foam cells, which form due to phospholipids accumulating in the macrophages in the alveoli. Again, you see that in a lot of different lung diseases, but if you don't see those foam cells, then that makes the diagnosis of amiodarone pulmonary toxicity unlikely. It seems like they try not to do lung biopsies on these patients if they don't have to. There's really no way to screen people or predict who might be more susceptible to this happening. And really the only thing to do about it is stop the amiodarone and treat them with steroids, which is what they did with our guy. Keep in mind that the toxicity might continue to progress for a while after you stop the amiodarone just because it has that crazy long half-life, so it's still going to be around for a while. From the up-to-date article, we suggest not, all caps, bold font, we suggest not resuming amiodarone in patients who have recovered from amiodarone-induced pulmonary toxicity due to the risk of recurrent disease and progressive pulmonary fibrosis. Check. It's hard to imagine a situation where a patient would require this medicine so much that you would take the chance of putting them back on it after the lung injury had happened. There's an antiarrhythmic similar to amiodarone called dronedarone. Nobody's really studied whether it would be likely to cause pulmonary toxicity if you put a patient on it after they had amiodarone toxicity. There have been some case reports where that dronedarone has caused lung toxicity. And apparently that dronedarone tends to increase mortality in patients with advanced heart failure, so seems like we're not going to see a lot of that. I don't think I've ever heard of that before. ACEs and ARBs might be protective against amiodarone lung injury, but we don't know that for sure yet. Other types of lung issues that can arise from amiodarone include eosinophilic pneumonia, organizing pneumonia, acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS, diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, pulmonary nodules and masses, and pleural effusion. Nobody ever really said that the pneumonia that our gentleman had was caused by the amiodarone, but it sounds like it could have been, as well as the pleural effusions he had. They did have the one culture that was positive for rhinovirus, so who knows? It's interesting to think that the ACEs and ARBs might be protective from this, since one of the big side effects you see with especially ACE inhibitors is that chronic cough. Of course, it's a whole different mechanism. The medicine inhibits that angiotensin-converting enzyme from degrading some substances that are harmful to the lung tissue. So it seems like that could go either way, right? Maybe the ACE or ARB is protective against amiodarone lung toxicity, or maybe you get amiodarone lung toxicity and lung damage from the effect of the ACE or ARB. But again, it doesn't seem like there's really a lot of research into that, so we don't know about that. All right, so that's all I have to say about amiodarone-induced lung toxicity. I really enjoyed putting this together. It turned out to be a lot more work than I thought it would be. Sorting through all those notes and trying to figure out the timeline and everything was a little challenging, but it was encouraging to see that I could get my hands on all that stuff if I really needed to. Obviously, I've not included anything that would identify this particular patient. Next time I see him, maybe I'll ask him or his wife if they want to come on the podcast and talk about the experience from their point of view. Next week's episode is actually going to complement this really well. It's a discussion of narrow complex tachycardia with a friend of mine who's a paramedic, a combat medic, and a patient with narrow complex tachycardia. That'll make 3 heart episodes in a row. Maybe we'll just make it a whole heart month, and the next critical incident will be about experiences with cardiac stuff that I've had. So anyway, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you next time. All right, that does it for this episode of Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to like, subscribe, or follow on your preferred listening platform. Give us a nice 5-star rating and leave a nice review. If you'd like to help support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/knowledgeableprovider. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients in that order. So 2 days after that office visit is his 6-month, shit, 2 days after, no, god damn it. Okay, that's enough for tonight.